You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Russ Feingold represented Wisconsin in the Senate for 18 years, and during that time, he gained a bit of a reputation as a maverick. He was the co-architect of a landmark campaign finance bill and the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. His new book, While America Sleeps, A Wake-Up Call for the Post-9/11 Era, tackles the changes that have gone on in America over the last decade. It's published by Crown, and I'm pleased to welcome Russ Feingold to our program today. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You write, loss of civil liberties and the undermining of our Constitution are not things that average Americans can readily discern in their daily lives. What kinds of rights and liberties do you think that we've lost in the post-9/11 era?
Well, we took a real hit in this area, and we didn't need to. I knew that we had to have a law to update some of our counterterrorism rules. For example, you could eavesdrop on somebody, wiretap somebody within certain rules, but you couldn't get a voicemail because the law didn't know what a voicemail was. That was reasonable. But what happened with the USA Patriot Act, and if you don't believe me, Bob Novak actually said it at the time, is they included what he called an old wish list of the FBI. Things that never would have been put in there. And frankly, they weren't even put in there necessarily to use against terrorists or al-Qaeda. For example, the ability to get somebody's library records without any proof that they've done anything wrong or connected to terrorists. So those problems with the Patriot Act have never been fixed. And the other area is the attack on the Constitution itself by the Bush administration by claiming that under the Commander-in-Chief powers, Article 2, he can just ignore laws like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which said only through certain procedures can you wiretap. This is an attack on the Constitution that was used to justify torture as well.
Well, haven't a lot of people been vocal about these issues, but they've had little success in convincing the general public that they should be concerned?
Well, it's gone through some phases in the last 10 years, and that's why I use the statement, while America sleeps. First, we obviously were somewhat unified, and we thought we were going to be able to stick together on this. Then these bad policies were done by the Bush administration, and there was opposition. There was opposition in places like Wyoming and Alaska. A lot of the very conservative people were worried about all this. Then Bush leaves the White House. Obama comes in, and the Tea Party says, you know what? We're not going to talk about guns, God, and gays anymore, social issues. We're not going to talk about foreign policy. We're not going to talk about civil liberties, even though many of these people claim to care about big government. They just said, we're just going to blame the economy on Obama and say that he's a socialist. So gradually, the whole sort of idea of criticism has been weeded out. And actually, one of the problems is people who are liberals on the left are hesitant to criticize because the president is now Obama. So we've lost a lot of ground in terms of opposition.
A number of people have pointed out that if you talk about the current political discourse, we've gone from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama, and there was nothing in between, even though George Bush was president for 8 years.
Yeah, they would like to pretend that. I mean, I had this experience in one of my town meetings. I relate the story in my book that, you know, we're sitting there a few months after Obama's sworn in, and a guy gets up and says, Obama, you know, did the bailout for the banks, and he did this and he did that. And I said, sir, that actually happened before this president was elected. And he was enraged that I said that, and he threw his sign in the air and walked out of the room because the plan was to somehow blame Obama for everything, even though he was sitting in the state Senate in Illinois when some of this happened.
But this is a bipartisan problem, isn't it? I mean, the post-9/11 issues that you're dealing with. You can't blame the Republicans for all of it.
Oh, no. But here's the problem. Every time a president has been elected in my lifetime, they usually give the guy a chance. You probably remember Herb Block, the wonderful cartoonist for the Washington Post. He was Richard Nixon's worst enemy on cartoons. But even on the day Richard Nixon was sworn in, he showed a barber's chair. And he said, every president gets a clean shave. So he gave him a break. Even Bush, when he was not really elected, the Supreme Court elected him. We didn't do this to him. But what they did to President Obama, despite the fact that we've been through this trauma in our country of 9/11 and Iraq and all that, they decided to destroy his presidency from the beginning. So I do believe that is different. I don't believe that's been done in my lifetime to any president. And I think it's wrong, and it's hurt us domestically, but it's also hurt us internationally.
And people like Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, absolutely said, you know, we are going to do everything possible to get to ensure that he's not reelected.
Yeah, he said he's concerned not about jobs, but about one job, replacing Barack Obama. And so, you know, I remember in my lifetime times when members and presidents of other parties were respected for what they were doing in the proper place. Of course, Kennedy, ich bin ein Berliner. But also, I remember even though I definitely wanted to defeat Nixon in 1972, we were all very proud of what he did with regard to China. And then Reagan, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. When President Obama goes to India, they make fun of him because he and his wife do a traditional dance. You know, this we're losing something in terms of our ability to work together.
But the big issue, at least at the start, was health care reform. Was Barack Obama naive to believe that he could get bipartisan support for it?
Well, I think it was something different. I think there would have been bipartisan support. And what the story I relate in the book, While America Sleeps, is exactly what I found out, which is I was meeting with Lindsey Graham, who I had worked with, a conservative senator from South Carolina. I had worked with him on a bipartisan state-by-state health care bill. Had a meeting with him and Jeff Bingaman. And should we introduce this bill again? The president's going to introduce his bill. And Lindsey just said, well, actually, the plan is already to bring Obama down on health care. I'm not saying that was Lindsey's plan. A few months later, of course, Jim DeMint said, we're going to make this President Obama's Waterloo. So he goes from being a president they claim they want to work with to being Napoleon. And so I think it was a conscious decision. It wasn't that the president was naive. He had every reason to believe that there could be bipartisan cooperation. And frankly, when he didn't get it, I think it was courageous of him to hang in there and get it done, because we do have this bill in place if the Supreme Court doesn't strike it down.
You were the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. Were there particular provisions that really bothered you?
Yeah. I did something, which I kidded around with people, I did something a little unusual. I actually read the bill because I was chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee. I found the provision that I've already mentioned, Section 215, which has to do with going after people's library and other personal records without any real proof that anybody's done anything wrong. But it wasn't just that. There's something called sneak and peek searches. These are rare exceptions to the general rule that you should have to have a search warrant to go into somebody's house. It allows the FBI to come in without telling you for a few days. Well, this thing was expanded without any real proof it had to do with terrorism to sort of a catch-all, and it could be 90 days or an indefinite period of time. We also had the development of something called national security letters that were so abused, the FBI could just issue them by themselves, that the Inspector General of the Justice Department issued a report saying, this thing is a mess. The director of the FBI actually called me the night before, Robert Mueller, who's actually done a good job, and he just said, you know, I'm sorry, Senator, that I have to tell you this report's coming out. So there are areas of abuse, and of course, we don't even know about so many others because it's classified.
And you're suggesting that they may very well be employing these different provisions right now without us knowing it?
Yes, that's what I believe.
You threatened to filibuster the Patriot Act. Why did you abandon that?
We didn't. We actually successfully stopped. Well, I didn't threaten to filibuster when it first passed. What I said was, look, I want to offer some amendments. And we were offered a very brief time to do amendments, and unfortunately my majority leader, Tom Daschle, got up when we were debating the amendments, and I was getting Republican support for some of the amendments, and he said, we need to vote against all these amendments on procedural grounds, and I was very unhappy with that. Now, later on, when they wanted to reauthorize the Patriot Act, there was one day when we successfully prevented the reauthorization. They ultimately got their way, but we actually did successfully mount a filibuster for a while. But in the end, no, we didn't win on it, and we still need to change it.
Partly because of the atmosphere in Washington at the time, you received a letter containing anthrax.
We did not, but our next-door neighbor, Senator Daschle, did. You're right. His mail room was right next to ours. My office was the only other one besides Senator Daschle where people actually tested positive for the anthrax.
Including your own staffers. No?
Right, three of them. Mm. They were fine, thank God, but it was a very dicey situation.
So there was also a feeling that Washington was under attack in ways that were different from the airplanes being flown into buildings.
Yeah, that was a point I wanted to make in my book that I think is not – a lot of people don't realize because they weren't there. You know, you'd drive out of my driveway in Wisconsin after 9/11 and you didn't see any barriers or any – new flower pots made out of cement or barbed wire. Washington became like an armed camp.
And so does New York, by the way.
Of course.
There are places in New York you could not drive through, even though there doesn't seem to be any real reason.
That would be the other place that I know of. And so, you know, I had been on Capitol Hill. My apartment was across the street. There was sort of this idyllic place that turned into not only a place where you couldn't walk, there was this huge hole for the building of the Capitol Visitor Center that looked like the, you know, the hole here and the one at the Boston Dig. Then you have these anthrax attacks, which, you know, even though they never made a connection to Al-Qaeda and it appears Al-Qaeda didn't do it, you thought they had. And then we had the D.C. sniper, who, of course, had absolutely nothing to do with this. But it was an environment where people were more ready to believe the phony arguments with regard to Iraq because they were nervous.
My guest is Russ Feingold, who's written a book called While America Sleeps, A Wake-Up Call for the Post-9/11 Era. You wanted President Bush censured over the warrantless wiretapping program. Do you think Congress clashed with the Bush administration aggressively enough over those kinds of things?
Well, I propose that because I felt there had to be some historical recognition that the president was trying to undo the Constitution, the balance between the executive and the legislative branch. Now, some people were calling for the impeachment of President Bush with regard to the Iraq war and other issues. I wasn't for that because I felt that it would be so disruptive, having already been through one impeachment trial that I was against. So I thought, what could we do? Let's pass a resolution of censure to at least have an historical record. Well, it turns out that hadn't been done since Andrew Jackson in the 1820s. So my daughter called me.
But he deserved it.
Whether he deserved or not, I can't speak authoritatively.
He undermined everything that Abraham Lincoln had.
No, Andrew Jackson. This is Jackson.
Oh, Jackson.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he
said all
the
Of course, Johnson was almost impeached, Andrew Johnson. But I thought this is something we can do as a people. I happen to think the warrantless wiretapping program was an impeachable offense. I thought it was a high crime and misdemeanor. And I don't say that in sort of a personal way. I just mean it was a direct attack on the Constitution as compared to Bill Clinton hiding gifts from Hillary Clinton.
On the other hand, you voted against dismissing the bill of impeachment against Clinton. You were the only Democrat to do that.
Well, we were sworn in as a jury for only the second time in American history. When you're sworn in as a juror, you have a responsibility to look at the charges. And I got to tell you, on the face of it, there were things that the President Clinton had done that looked like they might be obstruction of justice. And until I saw the evidence after we didn't dismiss it and heard Monica Lewinsky's deposition, I realized that the attempt to hide the gifts wasn't to evade federal prosecutors. It was to evade Hillary Clinton. And that's not a crime.
Despite the revelations about the wiretapping program, hasn't domestic surveillance been accelerated during the Obama administration?
I don't know if you can say it's been accelerated, but I am concerned that there are
cut back. As far
I'm concerned that there are not adequate safeguards. I do not have access, as I used to on the daily basis through the Intelligence Committee, to some of this information. But I do feel that there is not a strong enough attitude about limiting what we do to what we need to do. I remember when Edward Leavy was a Republican Attorney General who was very careful to talk about the constitutional rules and limitations. And we need more talk about that from this administration.
Well, right now, because of technology, we have much greater ability to monitor things. Like if I want to, I can find out where you are if you have an iPhone.
Yep. No, I think the National Surveillance Agency, the NSA, is important. We need that kind of help. But when somebody has that kind of power to monitor every one of our conversations, to know where we are, to do things that we never could have had been done to us unless we as a people don't care about privacy anymore, we have to deal with this. Now, I'm teaching now at Marquette. I was at Marquette last year. I'm out at Stanford University now. I got to be honest with you. Some young people are saying, well, we're not as concerned about privacy because we don't expect to have any. But those of us who are older, we certainly feel strongly about it, and I think many young people do too.
Are they still going around the request for FISA warrants these days?
All I can say is that a couple of United States senators, Senator Udall, I think Senator Merkley, who I believe sit on the Intelligence Committee, have said publicly there are things that are being done with regard to the Patriot Act and others that would shock people. So I am worried that that could be the case, but I cannot speak authoritatively on
that.
Well,
how often is a FISA warrant even turned down?
When the president did this thing, we found out that it had been approved 15,000 times and disapproved 4 times. So there appeared to be absolutely no reason for this. And actually, George Bush has admitted in his memoir that he should have proposed the legalization of this stuff. It probably would have gone through.
My guest is Russ Feingold, who represented the state of Wisconsin in the United States Senate from 1993 to 2011. And since leaving the Senate, he has been a visiting professor at Marquette University Law School in Milwaukee. He's written a book called While America Sleeps, A Wake-Up Call for the Post-9/11 Era. It's published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with former Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. He's written a book called While America Sleeps. It is published by Crown. President Obama did campaign on reversing the course on a number of Bush administration national security policies. So were you surprised when that he's kept so many of them in place with some adjustments? For example, they've accelerated certain programs like drone attacks in places like Yemen. Do you see any drawbacks for the employment of drones?
Well, I think it's true that the president has made some improvements. He immediately announced the banning of torture. He said he was going to close Guantanamo. That hasn't happened. But on a wide variety of issues, such as the use of what's called the state secrets privilege, which gives the government the ability to block lawsuits against civil liberties, they have kept the same deal. Now, with regard to drones, I mean, I think there are occasions where that can be an appropriate thing to use. But there are, you have to always consider, what's the impact on the surrounding population? I've heard reports from both Pakistan and Yemen that the attitude toward the United States when they believe it's being done inappropriately or excessively is very negative. So we have to balance doing something like that with regard to the whole picture, although I am delighted that some of these people have been taken out of the play, frankly.
What about the American-born radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed by a drone attack in Yemen? Many people felt that that was going too far because it was an attack on an American citizen.
That was a much tougher question, and it is because of what you just said. He was an American citizen. The administration did release an analysis of this, and it does suggest the law, which is if there was no way to take him alive, under those circumstances, given the fact that I think he was certainly an enemy of the United States and affiliated with a group that's an enemy of the United States, you can get him. But the factual question is, was that the only way? Our president says it was. If that's the case, I respect it and understand it. But
shouldn't there have been a trial first?
Well, the point is, if you can't take the person any other way, that's an exception. But I can't speak to whether that's the case. And I don't think we can go lightly with ideas of going after American citizens. On the other hand, if an American citizen has become part of an organization that's trying to destroy the United States, obviously there are some circumstances when we can take action.
Yeah, well, the problem is it's kind of hard to prove that without a trial, but that's a whole other matter. You mentioned Guantanamo. A Washington Post ABC News poll released this month found that 70% of Americans approve of President Obama's decision to keep open the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Even 53% of self-identified liberal Democrats and 67% of moderate or conservative Democrats support keeping the prison open. Why do you think the facility has so much broad support?
Well, naturally people have in their head that this is a place where so-called bad guys are kept and they can't hurt us. I understand that at one level. But it's not an accurate portrayal of what really happens with a facility like Guantanamo. It creates an image problem for us around the world that is very costly, and there are other ways to get at this. The notion that somehow we can't try these guys in a regular court is just wrong. We just were able to convict the Christmas Day bomber in a regular court, and yes, there would be circumstances where people might be sent back to the countries they came from, but I think the continuation of a facility like that is something that we should avoid, and I believe that if people knew more about what was happening there and the problem it causes for our image, that more people would be in favor of closing it.
You said that you would have liked to have seen the Bush administration censured. What do you think of the Obama Justice Department's decision not to pursue cases against Bush administration officials like John Woo for their role in what's been described as enhanced interrogation techniques?
I'm not sure it's a good idea to have not had some accountability for those that were involved in these practices. Now, I understand that the people that actually did the interrogation may have been in a situation where they were informed it was legal. But a guy like John Yoo, who wrote those opinions, this guy has been so fast and loose with the Constitution.
And now he's teaching at Berkeley Law School.
Principal architect of this idea of the commander-in-chief that essentially destroys the Constitution. It destroys the whole idea that the Congress makes the law and the president signs it. So I'm not saying that it would be right to prosecute, but the idea that he's just fine, that there's nothing wrong with it, that he's a legitimate law professor, in my view, he has such little regard for the Constitution that the story of his influence hasn't even really been told. It was a disastrous influence.
You write a bit about the booming anti-terror and corporate lobbying that has arisen to exploit 9/11. What companies are you talking about?
Well, one thing I'm talking about is the enormous lobbying influence that many countries in the world have in Washington. I'll give you an example where McCain and I tried to do a resolution to question Hosni Mubarak's umpteenth attempt to extend his emergency powers. In 2010, we offered a resolution to say, wait a minute, this isn't a good idea. This could really cause a real explosion in Egypt. Well, a lobbying firm constituted Bob Livingston, the former Speaker of the House, Toby Moffett, a former House member, and one of the Podestas, who, of course, were very close to the Clintons. They killed the bill. This was a perfectly reasonable bill, and they said this would be an affront to our friend in Egypt. Well, it was an affront to the Arab Spring. So the connection between big money, foreign money coming in to pay for permanent lobbyists in Washington, distorts our foreign policy in a very serious way.
And then it doesn't play well in Egypt, and we don't understand that.
Yeah, it's a huge mistake to just pick somebody like Musharraf or somebody in Yemen or somebody and say, well, this is our guy. Well, these are countries that aspire to democracy, and when we play the role of picking some despot or dictator, it makes people very disillusioned with the United States.
But do we even have a comprehensive national strategy for the whole Middle East? Since 9/11, the United States has invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. We've conducted military operations in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. We bombed or proxy bombed Libya in that war. It sounds to me like we have no overarching strategy plan here.
That's how it feels, and that's why I write in this book, While America Sleeps, I write the chapter I call A Game of Risk. I try to compare what we did to that game that we all played called Risk. Risk is a game where if you invade a country and you have your troops on that country's space, you can't take all your troops out of there. You got to keep them there. So this is kind of what we did. We kind of invaded country by country, Afghanistan, then Iraq, and we got it in our head that when we went there, we had to stay there, in for a penny, in for a pound. That is not the nature of the challenges we have. As we were doing that, al-Qaeda is operating in 60 different countries. It's in Southeast Asia with the Jamia Islamia. It's in Northern Africa. I think there are groups that look very much like al-Qaeda in Nigeria, clearly al-Shabaab in Somalia.
And now people are calling for war in Iran.
Right. And so what happens is now that we see that there's this global challenge that still exists, everybody goes, well, it's Iran now. So we can only think about one country at a time, and that is not the way we need to approach the world in the 21st century.
Russ Feingold is my guest. His book, While America Sleeps, is published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In this election cycle, the phrase American exceptionalism is being thrown around a lot. You write that conservatives use the phrase as a way to thwart serious attempts to reposition our country as a leading nation in a far more complex world. So how should we reposition ourselves?
Well, you know, to replace having a real understanding of the rest of the world with a phrase like American exceptionalism is foolish. Now, I happen to think America is exceptional. I happen to think it's the greatest country in the world. But to make your foreign policy, as Mitt Romney does and as Rick Santorum does, basically just saying, I believe America is exceptional, end of story, to me is flies in the face of what your parents might have told you, which is, you know, it's not nice to brag and people won't like you if you do. It's like you can feel you're exceptional, but what about walk softly and carry a big stick? What about George Bush is saying we should be humble? We need to be concerned about the way we come off to the rest of the world, and these guys just want to rile up people against the president because he's trying to have a more positive connection to the rest of the world. We need that positive connection.
We had the founders of one of the Tea Party groups on our show recently, and American exceptionalism is a keystone of their thinking. So how much of this do you think is a response to the rise of the Tea Party?
Oh, I think it's part of it. It's been a mantra of the Republicans for some time. You know, they don't want to talk about foreign policy for a couple of reasons. Number one is George Bush made a lot of mistakes, and they don't want to own those mistakes. They also don't want to admit that Barack Obama has done a pretty darn good job on foreign policy. Here's a guy that's made positive trips to India and Indonesia, made an important speech in Cairo. Around the world, people are saying, we really do like the way President Obama comes off. Well, they don't want to hear that. And, of course, Osama bin Laden's gone, al-Awlaki's gone, Gaddafi's gone. They don't want to talk about that either because George Bush didn't get that done. Obama did. So what the Tea Party says is the issue on a presidential candidate is, do you believe in American exceptionalism? It's a mindless replacement for having a serious bipartisan international policy.
Well, you were defeated by a Tea Party-backed candidate in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was once a bastion of liberal politics, the state of Robert
M. La Follette, and of Joe McCarthy.
That's true.
We have a couple of traditions.
Now you have a Republican-controlled legislature, a governor, Scott Walker, who has caused quite a bit of a stir by trying to make it Wisconsin a right-to-work state. Has Wisconsin changed totally, or is this just a blip?
Even my opponent and the Republicans know darn well that anyone basically could have won all those elections in 2010. Here was the situation. You had a Democratic president, Democratic House, Democratic Senate. You had a Democratic governor in Wisconsin, Democratic Assembly, Democratic State Senate. People were upset because the economy, and it's sort of a normal human thing, they just said, we're just going to vote against all the incumbents. So the Republicans benefited from that, but it's not going to last. And particularly in Wisconsin, it's not going to last because Scott Walker went directly at the throats of the working people of Wisconsin by taking away collective bargaining rights of public employees. And those public – we were the first state to ever create the collective bargaining rights for public employees. So he is being recalled. Over a million signatures were filed, and the candidates are lining up. And we will probably have an election, I think, a new governor as soon as early June.
Really?
And
that's, I think he's going to –
I think
he's
we got a real
lose.
Shot. I think we'll beat him. It's going to be a very tough race with possibly $100 million spent. But this will be a real sign to the right that they basically benefited from a bad economy and took advantage of it, but they're not solving the problems. They're making things worse.
Well, let's talk about that $100 million spent, because we're seeing millions and millions of dollars being spent during this election cycle. People associate your name with the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Much of it has been kind of undercut by Supreme Court decisions. Would you say Citizens United pretty much eviscerated that law?
Well, here's how you look. And by the way, apart from the subject of my book was this international policy, the thing I've been spending much of my time on since leaving the Senate is the issue of money in politics. I've created a group called Progressives United, which is a response to the Citizens United decision, progressivesunited.org. Anyway, what this is about is that McCain and I built the McCain-Feingold bill, which is still the law. 90% of it's still the law. The main thing is that you can't give the money directly to the political parties and politicians can't raise it. Unfortunately, Citizens United took away the entire foundation that was from 1907 under Teddy Roosevelt and 1947 under the Taft-Hartley Act. So this thing still prevents that. But now we have this enormous, unprecedented abuse of corporations and unions being able to use their treasuries. So you buy toothpaste, you buy a gallon of gas, they can now use that for political advertising in the first time in American history. This is one of the worst decisions in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it needs to be overturned.
The argument is that money is a form of speech.
Well, that is not really what the Supreme Court said. In Buckley v. Valeo, they said, yes, unless the money either corrupts or has the appearance of corruption. Well, a couple of justices on the current Supreme Court said the other day that they basically see a lack of independence of these expenditures, that it actually is very questionable. And I think what they're seeing is that this is, in fact, the corrupting exception to the rule that it's speech. And I think that's how we're going to be able to turn it around.
Were you surprised when your friend John McCain backtracked on the law during his presidential campaign?
Yeah. I mean, I think John was under enormous pressure during the presidential campaign. They also tried to Tea Party him out. But I am pleased to say that we are back on track. He joined with me on the day of the second anniversary of Citizens United. Even though I'm not in the Senate, we did a joint statement saying this is wrong. He's been making powerful statements about what he knows, which is there's going to be a huge scandal because of this. And there's going to be another round of changes. But I'm very pleased that John is working on this issue again.
You write about this country's lack of awareness about the world. Whose fault is it? Is that the media's fault?
You know, I would put it at three different levels. First of all, it's our history. I mean, Winston Churchill wrote that England was used to being an island, and it's one of the reasons they weren't prepared. We were used to basically being an island for 200 years, so it's sort of our default position.
But 9/11 was supposed to have changed all of that.
That's the point of my book, is that 9/11 should have changed it. So the second thing is that, of course, the economy becoming so problematic in the last couple of years caused people to move away. But the real problem is the cynical manipulation, especially from the right, of saying, let's not talk about social issues, let's not talk about international issues, let's just talk about Obama and what a bad guy he is. That has had the worst influence of dumbing down our conversation so that we are no longer preparing ourselves and protecting ourselves by knowing the rest of the world. We're just fighting here in the United States, and I think it's enormously dangerous.
But when people say Obama's a socialist or that he's not a citizen, that he doesn't have a birth certificate, doesn't that just simply isn't that only supported by the true believers?
Well,
that's what America dismisses.
That's what our election this year is going to be all about. Is it possible to destroy a presidency from day one by lying about a president and making up awful stories about him? Or does Barack Obama succeed? I think he succeeds, and I think because they tried so hard to destroy him, he will be a very powerful and effective president in his second term. Frankly, I can't wait.
Social issues are roaring back into the political arena, especially from the Rick Santorum campaign.
It'll be a mistake. The American people do know that we need to focus on our economic issues. I hope that after we talk about some of these issues, they know we need to get serious about international issues. And going back to fighting about gays and abortion and so on is not a good way for our future. All it does is divide us. And basically, I think Americans want to be left alone. And especially our younger generations are not attracted to this kind of extreme social division.
Russ Feingold's book from Crown is called While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It was a delight.